Good afternoon. So, last time, we talked about how system calls work in XV6. We mentioned that, well, when we are writing our normal programs and want to use a system call, we want it to kind of look like a function call. So we had this idea of a system call wrapper, that we'd have some sort of function that would represent the system call like a normal function call. Of course, we can't actually call a system call like a normal function call. So it would be this little function whose only purpose would be to translate from a function call to a system call. And on XV6, that just meant running some special instruction that triggers an exception. And once we had an exception triggered, well, for the system call to work, we needed to have the processor know where to go. And at boot, XV6 sets up the interrupt table, aka the exception table, to have this information for the processor. And XV6, in fact, installs a whole lot of handlers for different types of exceptions, all of which end up calling the kernel function trap. And this kernel function trap uses information that's saved before the call. So before we call trap, we save all the registers, and also which type of exception triggered the trap in this structure we call the trap frame. And then the trap function uses that information to figure out what to do. So for a system call, it says, oh, the type of the trap that triggered it was a system call. And then there's some convention that they use for system calls that defines where the arguments are, how you figure out what type of system call it is. And XV6's convention, like many operating systems, they said, we're going to make it look a lot like a normal function call and only have a few little things different. And the little things that are different are basically just that to specify what system call you're doing, you set EAX. And this meant that the system call wrapper had a lot less work to do. It just set EAX to say it's a write, it's a read, or whatever system call we were doing, and then just invoke the system, and the arguments were in the same place we'd expect for a normal function call. So there's no extra work to do from the system call wrapper side of things. Of course, we have to do the work of retrieving those arguments, but that's going to be some work no matter how they're stored. We also mentioned, well, if all these system call, all the exception handlers rather work by calling trap, let's look at how some of the other types of exceptions are handled. And basically, there's just some if statements and switch statements in trap that decide what to do for something like a key press or a timer expiring and so on. Those are all handled with the same basic mechanism. We just have different values and therefore different actions to take once we get into trap. And one of the things that we do typically on non-system calls is context switches. That sometimes we're running one program, we want to switch to another program. We can do this from a system call if, like, the system call asks to wait for input, we don't have input right away. Or we can do this from something else, like if the timer expires, we want to switch to a different program so we don't keep running the same program forever if there's more than one thing to run. And to do this, we need to do what's called a context switch. The name comes from this idea of a context, that when we're running on the processor, we have certain information that the processor is keeping track of, the registers, the current program counter, and so on. We call that collectively a context. And we have one context on the processor, and, well, we also have programs which aren't on the processor right now, and we're going to store their context in memory. We're going to store the information that would be on the processor in memory, and sometimes we do a context switch, where we swap that information that's on the processor with information in memory somewhere to go from one program to another. And we mentioned sort of one part of how context switching works in XV6, which is that we have this trick that when we handle exceptions, even when we don't have to switch to another program, we do all this work of, before we call trap, saving what the user program was doing. And also, when trap is done, we ordinarily restore what the user program was doing. And we already have that code to handle exceptions generically. And it's very similar to the sort of work we want to do for a context switch, where we want to save the current state of the program to memory and restore it. And in fact, that's exactly how we save and restore what the program was doing outside the kernel. It's exactly the saving that happens before we call trap to keep track of what the program was doing. And we'll think, today we'll go over the rest of the context switch, probably the trickier to understand part. So before I move on to that, questions about things we covered last time? Yes?
So the trap frame is just kind of like saving what state of the process was before switching it over to the kernel mode code?
Question, the trap frame saves the state of the process before switching to kernel mode? Yes. So that's the information we put there. Yes. Other questions? Yeah? So when I showed you how XV6 set up the interrupt descriptor table, which is what Intel calls the interrupt or exception table, I showed you this setgate macro, and one of the things we specified is that is this K code thing to say run in kernel mode. And your question is, what happens if we don't do that? So I guess a first answer to that is you are probably not going to find a current DOS which doesn't do that. It doesn't do something equivalent to that. But technically, you can make the processor on an exception run something that's not in kernel mode. This is not a feature that OSs really care about, and it's not a feature that many processors actually provide. But x86 allows it, even though I don't know of anyone who actually uses it. Does that answer your question? Okay. Yeah. Can I describe the difference between user stack and kernel stack? So in user mode, we use the user stack. In kernel mode, we use the kernel stack. So that's the difference. Why do we have a different one? Well, one reason is that we don't want the stuff the kernel does to ever interfere with the stuff that's being done by the application outside of kernel mode, or vice versa. Does that answer your question?
Yep.
Okay. Other questions? Okay, so one piece of logistics. We have a quiz. This is not the quiz site, but the quiz site is linked from the normal site. It looks kind of like this. So a quiz that is due next Tuesday before the first lecture, so like around noon, not around 3, because I don't want people doing the quiz during my lecture. And that will be assigned sometime this evening around 8 p.m. I have some time after this lecture, so if I don't get to something I expect you to get to, I can modify the quiz so we don't ask you about things you don't know. And I'm just going to go over the interface for the quiz site. This is not the actual quiz. So when you take a quiz, you'll get to, I should do the demo with. So if we go, if you take a quiz, it will ask you, do you really want to take it? And you'll be able to select options. And when your answer is recorded, the box will return green around your answer. If it doesn't turn green like this, then your answer has not been recorded. Also, there is a space to enter comments on questions. So some comment, and when you focus out of this box, your answer is recorded. We will read those comments at some point and use them to adjust your grade. This is what you should do if you think a question is unclear or needs more information or is wrong. That's what the comment is for. If we think the question is bad, we will probably adjust it for everyone. If you just have a misunderstanding, this is how to deal with it. I generally will not be able to give corrections to the quiz questions, because if someone takes the quiz on Thursday night or Friday morning, and then you come up with a question about it, and I have to give the correction on like Sunday or Monday, I don't think that's very nice for people who have carefully planned to not need to do the quiz on their busy class day of Monday. So generally, I will not be able to give corrections. If the question is unclear enough, I will just, you know, drop it or adjust, give credit for lots of answers. And otherwise, you know, I'll grade it as written. And generally, if you think the question's clear, we will have a human read the comments. I will note that that won't happen automatically. So when you fill in a quiz, after the quiz is due, it will be graded, and we'll have this automated system, which will like use the answers that are marked in the key. Grading of comments is not going to be so automatic. That will happen by hand. So as an example, here, I wrote a comment for the question, and a grader eventually got to it and wrote a reply to that with no grade adjustment. There could have been a grade adjustment, depending on what they thought about that reply. And that would overwrite, you know, this wrong answer here. Also, on the grading page, things that are notable. So we have the mean score among all students for the question. These percentages here are the percentage of students who answered each of those options. That's available to you, and the correct answers are marked, or they'll be marked in a different way on the quiz, because I have an older version for this demo. But correct answers will be marked when you look at the actual quiz site. So questions about the quiz? So I'm just reminding you that there's one signed tonight due next Tuesday before the first lecture. And yes, there's no time limit, so you can look at it early. But as I mentioned, if you think a question's unclear or something, that's what the comments field is for. Generally, we're not going to be able to help you clarify the question because we can't really do that fairly for everyone who takes the quiz at different times. Okay. So last time we were talking about sort of context switch from a high level, then let's look now at how it works in XV6. So in XV6, generally, some exception will happen. It will run the exception handler that will call trap and so on. And eventually, we'll decide that rather than handling this exception and then going back to the same program we were running, in this case, application A, we're going to decide that we want to run some different application B that was previously stopped and stop application A temporarily until we go back to it later. And to do this in XV6, we're going to call a special function that's written in assembly. We'll see exactly how it's written later, called switch. And what switch is going to do is it's going to save all the information in the kernel, the registers being used by the kernel on the stack, and it's going to restore the registers being used by the kernel for application B from its stack. You might say, why are they on B stack? Well, because B called switch earlier. You might say, what about the first, how do we start this process? We'll get to that later. So B called switch earlier, which is why you can restore its registers from its stack, because they were saved just like A's are being saved. So we restore it, and we restore the state of B, and we return back up to whatever B was doing before it stopped running and switched to something else. And eventually, B is going to return back to the user code. It's going to return from whatever called the trap it used to be doing. It's going to restore its saved registers from the trap frame and go back to application B. Some questions about this sort of high-level view of what happens when we switch from one application to another? Yes? So is this on a per thread or a per core basis? So I'm not sure what you're asking is per thread or per core. So this is a switch from one thread to another. So application B, A has a thread, and application B has a thread. And we're switching from the application A thread to the application B thread. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
OK. Other questions? Yeah. So the question, why is the vector function appear here when we're going back to B? So I'm just, we go back to whatever trap returns to. If you're being nitpicky, you might say, wait a moment, that's really in a different part of the assembly file. But I'm calling it vector XX in the sense that probably that's, you know, what you call it if you like were like making it a debugger. Yeah.
What exactly is the trap frame again?
Question, what is the trap frame? The trap frame is the place where we save what the user program is doing before an exception happened. It's also, remember, we pass to the trap function these arguments, which are the state of the program, and also what caused the exception. That's the trap frame. That's the name of that struct. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, and we talked about there being multiple stacks. So all the stuff that application A does runs using application A's user stack. When it's in user mode, when it switches to kernel mode from the exception, all that stuff uses application A's kernel stack. And the switch function is going to do the work of changing which stack we're using from the A kernel stack to the B kernel stack. And everything there is going to use B's kernel stack, and then we're going to return to use B's user stack. And sort of a more concrete example might be that, you know, the most common case of a context switch we're going to think about is a timer interrupt. That, you know, A was running for long enough and the timer expired, and XV6's code, which just says when a timer goes off, switch to something else if there's something else to switch to. And the way that works is that the timer interrupt happens, it has number 32, so it will go to the assembly function vector 32, that will call trap. Trap will say, oh, this was a timer expiring, so I'm going to call the yield function, which is going to figure out another program to switch to, and it's going to use switch to do that. And then the switch function is going to switch to B, and B is going to go back to doing whatever it was doing. And B, we don't know why it stopped, which is why I have the question marks there, right? We could have switched away from B earlier because of a timer expiring. We could have switched away from B because it was waiting for input and it wasn't available at the time. There's lots of different reasons. Yes? Question, what's the difference between user registers and kernel registers? By user registers, I mean the registers we were last using in user mode, and by kernel registers, I mean the registers we were last using in kernel mode. Wouldn't the user registers be stored in the user stack? No, because the code that runs to save those registers has to run in kernel mode, because that's the first opportunity we have to do it. Because in order to save them, we have to do it as part of the exception handler. We don't have any earlier opportunities to do so. Does that answer your question? Yes.
In the trap frame.
Question, and that's stored in the trap frame, yes, that we passed to trap. Yes.
Is there a particular reason why the user registers are saved via a C function and the kernel registers are saved via an assembly function?
Question, is there a reason the user registers are saved by a C function and the kernel registers are saved by an assembly function? I would argue that they're all saved by assembly functions. So this vector 32 function saves the user registers. This switch function saves the kernel registers. They're both assembly. They're both written in assembly. And they kind of have to be because you can't really save registers in C very easily. C function, trap, and yield. So the question is, why are those C and not assembly? So since we don't need to do something special like deal with registers directly, we can have those written in C. And XV6 basically says, I'd rather write in C than write in assembly. So we're only writing pieces that we have some reason need to be in assembly. And it's mainly because we have to deal with registers directly in those two functions. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so one thing that comes up is that, well, to do this switch, we somehow need to know we're switching to B, which means we need to have some way of representing what, you know, application B. And generically speaking, we're going to have this, you know, a pointer to the saved regs, and also we're going to need some more information. We'll talk in a couple weeks about what other information we might want. Actually, probably later today, we'll talk a little bit about it, more in a couple weeks. So we need information about a thread in general, and the generic term for that you've seen in like textbooks is a thread control block. Some struct that has information about a thread. That's going to include how to get its saved register so you can switch to it. It's also going to include other information like whether you should run it now or not, or if it's waiting for something. We'll go to through specific examples later. Related to this, there's also process control blocks. So remember, we said a process is a thread, or it's one or more threads plus an address space. Now, in XV6, processes have exactly one thread. So XV6 kind of conflates thread and process control blocks. So there's in XV6, a process control block is stored as a struct proc. So it represents a process. And because every process has exactly one thread, rather than having a separate struct for thread information, they just put it in the process struct. So it doubles as the thread control block. On an OS that supports multi-threaded processes, you wouldn't do that. Okay. So questions about this idea of a thread control block and a process control block? Yes. The question is, I'm trying to say that these two things are, thread and process control blocks are different, but in XV6 they're the same, is what you're asking? In XV6? So yeah, I'm saying in XV6, they are basically, they're the same, but yeah, in general, that's not going to be true. There's going to be some things in the process control block there's some things in XV6's struct proc that are really part of the thread control block, and some which are really part of the process control block. And on an OS that supported multiple threads per process, basically our process control block, one of the things it would have would be something like an array of thread control blocks. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah. So question is, what does the process control block have that the thread control block doesn't have? So we'll see some specific examples later, but a good example would be information about the address space, because that's shared between all the threads. All the threads have like access to the same heap, for example. So that information is part of the process control block, not the thread control block. Or information about open files, because all the threads share the same open files. Does that answer your question? Yes. So your question, thread control block is information about one thread, process control block is stuff that's shared, plus pointers to all the thread control blocks for a process. Yeah. But in XV6, we have exactly one thread control block, so they just don't bother having an array. Just drop it right in. Other questions? Okay, so now that we know about control blocks, let's think about where we store information during a context switch. And I'm showing you sort of a picture of memory that's available to program, and I kind of separated out stuff that's only accessible to the kernel and stuff that went above that, which is going to be what we can access in user mode with, you know, addresses which are in the bottom half of memory. And when we're running process A, we're using all of this A stuff, some of which is in the user mode, some of we can access, you know, not during an exception handling, some of which isn't. But while we're running process A, while we haven't switched away, this is the stuff we have access to. So this is what is A's address space. So when we're in kernel mode, we have access to all of the stuff, including process B stuff. And that's important because it's going to be actually a little tricky to switch to B if we can't read its stuff. So we need to be able to do that. So this is the address space A has access to. And so when we have an exception happen in process A, we can all access all of process B stuff. That's fine. But when we're running in user mode, that's not going to be possible. And B's address space is going to be similar. We have access to B's user stack in user mode and not A's. But in kernel mode, we have access to everything. And where things are going to be stored is, well, when A is running, you know, it's using its stack. When it's running in user mode as like our normal application code, and when an exception happens, we're going to save its registers before we call trap. and restore them after trap returns if we go back to doing whatever I was doing before, like a system call or timer or interrupt or something else happened. So we have that, and that's stored before we call trap, so it's a local variable in the code that calls trap, so it's stored in the kernel stack in that trap frame struct as it happens. And that code in trap, sometimes it decides to switch away from A, and it's going to call switch when it does that. And what switch is going to do, or what calling switch is going to do, we'll see that it's not all done by switch itself, is it's going to save all the kernel registers so we can remember what we were doing before we called switch. And what XV6 has chosen is that we save them all on the stack, on the kernel stack. But of course, if we're saving them on the kernel stack, we still need to be able to find them. So we're going to pass a pointer to them in the struct proc, the thread control block for A and B. So we're going to have a pointer to the save registers so we can find them later when we want to switch back to A, or when we're switching from A to B, so we need to supply something to switch to. We need to find that thing. We're going to find it with this pointer in the thread control block to the saved values. And that's therefore what we're going to pass as arguments to the switch function. So questions about sort of this high level view here of where we're saving information? Yes, back there.
So the struct proc is like the thread control block?
Yes, the struct proc is our thread control block. Yes. Yeah.
Why does in user mode a process need to see its own kernel stack if it can't really use it until it enters kernel stack?
So the question is, why in user mode does a process need to see its own kernel stack? So it doesn't see its own kernel stack because it's below the kernel moment. Only memory line. But when an exception happens, we want to use that stack, which is why I had it as stuff we use, where we definitely use while running process A. Because like when A makes system calls, we're going to use that stack. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? So we have this switch function, and I tell you it takes these two pointers, which are, these two things that are pointers to our stack. And we, in fact, need to modify one and read the other. So this is the prototype for switch. So it takes a pointer to pointer to what's called a struct context. So a struct context is just the type they use to represent that set of save registers that's going to happen to be the last thing pushed on one of the kernel stacks. So the first argument is when I said old. So if we're switching from A to B, we need to save the pointer where A's registers are stored somewhere. We're going to use old to know where to save those. So that's why I say we save to star old, because it's a pointer to pointer. We need to reference it to figure out where to save it. So we're going to pass a pointer to the thing in the process, the thread control block, where to store that. And the second argument, what I call new, is where we want to read the new registers to switch to. So if we're switching from A to B, this would be a pointer to B stack where those registers are stored. So questions about our prototype? Yes, back there.
Why is it double star?
So old is something we're going to modify based on where the stack is after we push. The new is we're only going to set the stack there and start popping. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay. So, and as I said, these context pointers just are going to be the thread stack pointers where our context for the kernel mode stuff is stored, for the stuff that we were doing in the kernel before we switched. So now that we know how this works, let's think of what the semantics of this sort of at just as a function we could call from CR. So I have an example here, and something we kind of need to make this work is I mentioned that like when we call switch, we're assuming you have something set up to switch to from a prior call to switch. So we haven't dealt with the issue of wait a moment. We can't have a first call to switch if that's true. We're going to fix that later. So for this example, I'm assuming that sometime earlier, thread B called switch here, where I marked 0, and set up this B context. And so what happens is I'm running thread A, and I run this code in the dot, dot, dots, and then I call switch here, and I'm switching from A to B, and B has previously been saved from that prior call to switch, and we're going to save A's context because of this call to switch. A is the old, B is the new. So what that's going to mean is after I run 1 here, I'm going to have this call to switch, and rather than returning to A, I'm going to return after that call to switch in B. So I'm going to call switch in A there and return from that prior call to switch in B. Questions? Our weird function here. Yes?
It says in thread A. I think it's just confusing me whether that's like the code that's actually in the application or if that's being performed.
So the question is this kernel or application code? So this stuff is all about the kernel part of the context switch, so this is all kernel code. Does that answer your question? We'll get back briefly to how it interacts with the user part, but this is all about the kernel part of the context switch, which is probably the trickiest part. Other questions? Okay, so we have this call from to switch in A, which returns to B, then B keeps going, and later on, we happen to have this call here where we switch from B, we save the current state to B, overriding whatever was there before, and switch back to A. So this call here is going to, we're going to call in B and return from that prior call to switch in A. And this code that's after this call to switch in B, well, nothing here runs it. So if we don't do anything else, it never gets run. We could run it later on by calling switch with the argument B context, but there's no call on the slide that does that. Okay, some questions? How we jump around here? Yes. Question, why is there a difference between switching and calling? Question, why would it, so it, why would we do this instead of having B just call A? So remember we want to achieve our overall goal of, like, we're running program 1 and then we switch to program 2. And something notable here is if you think of what happened in thread A, let's start with one simpler answer for why we might do this. So in this example, I have thread A and thread B, and I'm switching from A to B and vice versa. But on a real system, we often have like thread A, B, C, D, E, and depending on what's available to run, maybe you switch from A to B, B to C, C to D, D to A, or, you know, sometimes maybe we only switch from A to B to C to A, you know, that's going to vary, right? We want something where that still works regardless. And that's not easy to do as sort of a function call. So that's one sort of way of thinking about it. Another is that, if we think of B here, you know, we don't want B to be coupled to A. Like, if A needs to exit, we want to still be able to run B later on. And if we just did this as this sort of thing as like function calls, that wouldn't really work. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
Is there a limit to how many threads you can switch to?
The question, is there a limit to how many threads you can have? The limit is basically how much space do you have to store context? Because we need a stack for each thread. And also a thread control block for each thread. But that's your limitation. Yes.
And how do you know that it's going to go to the line right after the opposite switch statement?
So question, how do I know it's going to go to the line after the opposite switch statement? So the way switch works is it always returns from another call to switch when you switch to someone. And what call to switch does it return from? The one that set up that context. So that context has the information needed to return to the call switch. So what might that information be? We'll find out that it's actually the return address of switch. And that's why it returns to the right place. Other questions? Yeah.
Oh, so you're saying that the process is going to save where that switch happens, right? Like there's a stack pointer that's going to
So the question is, we're somehow saving where the switch happened? Yes. And we'll see. In fact, the mechanism for doing that is this very elegant mechanism that the way we're saving that is that it's the return address for switch, which is already on the stack, because we call switch. But yes, we are saving where the switch happened, and that's very necessary to go back to the right piece of code. Other questions? So now that we know roughly what the semantics of the switch function are, if we're like using it from C, let's talk about how it's implemented. Because this is a real function implemented in assembly that works this way. So how do we do that? And I'm going to show the code that runs when we call switch A, B. And this code includes the stuff that we're doing just to call a function and return from a function, as well as the code that's actually in the assembly for switch. So one of the elegant things about the design that XV6 has chosen here is that a lot of the work of saving the context is actually being done by the compiler when it calls switch. So we have two stacks involved. That's why I have two diagrams here. And we make a call to switch. The first thing that happens is the compiler needs to generate a call to switch. And to do that, we need to put the arguments to switch on the stack, because that's what the calling convention says. That's where the arguments are. And we also need to put the return address of switch on the stack, because that's the calling convention, and also how the call instruction works. So the compiler, when we call switch, is doing this part of writing things to the stack. And this is actually very useful, because we need to save some registers, all the registers for this. We also need to save where to go back to after we switch back. And the compiler has done that for us. Save where to go back to. And also it saved some of the registers. Why just some? Because our calling convention says that some of the registers you need to worry about being changed when you call a function. Some you don't. The compiler has saved the caller safe registers, the one that you, if you call a function, need to assume that function changes. And it also is going to write the return address to the stack, because that's how a function call works. And then we finally get to the code that's in our function switch that we actually need to write, that we couldn't rely on the compiler writing. So what that code's going to do is it's going to save all the callee safe registers. Why just the callee safe registers? Well, because the compiler, in order to call switch, saved all the caller safe ones, so we don't need to worry about it. We could have saved them, but that would just be a waste of space. They're already saved. So once we've saved all that, we have all the information we need to go back to A here. We have all the register values that matter. We have the address to jump back to as the return address. All the information except we need to store the stack pointer somewhere. So we're going to stash the stack pointer based on that first argument A. So we're going to use that pointer to pointer to save that stack pointer. So we remember where all this information is, we need to run A later on. So now we've done this part of saving what A was doing so that we can go back to it later. We go start running B. So the first thing we do is we take B and we set our stack pointer to point to B. So now we're on B's stack. And we're going to undo what B must have done earlier when it did that first half of this operation. So we're going to do that in reverse order because we're dealing with a stack, you know, first on, first out. So we're going to pop all the registers that we just saved for A, but we're going to pop them from B's stack, so we're going to save pop B's versions that were saved earlier. Get all those callee save registers. Then we're going to use the return address by using the RET instruction. So we're going to jump back to the code that called switch in B, which is probably different than the code that called switch in A. And then because B was a function call to switch that might have needed to save some registers, the compiler will have generated code as part of that function call to restore those registers it saved. And that code is going to run and get restore any of the remaining registers. So questions about this sort of outline of what the switch function is? Yes? Question, are these two stacks the user stacks or the kernel stacks? These are the kernel stacks. So the user part is that because these are part of a call to trap, somewhere way up on the stack, there was a call to trap with save registers from the argument to trap. And eventually, when we return from the function that called switch in B, we'll restore those. And we save those in A, you know, well before we got to the call to switch. Yes? Question, where is the old stack pointer saved? So it's saved wherever the argument A pointed to, and that's going to be a pointer to part of the thread control block. So we have just in XV6, basically we have an array of processes, process control blocks, and it's going to be saved in there. And we'll talk, when we talk about scheduling in a couple weeks, about exactly what the structure of that is and how we find things in it, and so on. Yes? Question, the A argument is the pointer to that thread or process control block? Yes. Other questions? Yes? Question, what is caller versus callee safe registers? So when we make function calls, we have to make a choice about what happens to register values. So there's two extremes. So one extreme we can take is we could say, when you call a function, you need to assume that all the register values change. In this case, that means that in order to use registers across a function call, you would need to save all of them, so all the registers would be caller saved. That choice would be very inconvenient if it applied to all registers, because often you want to have like a local variable that you still use after a function call without pushing and popping things. We could therefore make the opposite choice and say, when you call a function, that function can't use any registers unless it saves them first and restores them before returning. But that's also very inconvenient because we'd really like to be able to quickly use a quick temporary value. So typically in a calling convention, we're going to choose some registers that are caller saved that you have to save when you make a call, and some registers that are callee saved that if you use them, you have to save them. And that's the difference. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay. I mentioned that a lot of this work is done by the compiler because of the existence of caller save registers. So we know roughly what the switch function does. Let's look at the assembly. And the assembly is not going to include all the stuff the compiler does because that's not part of the function. That's part of how a compiler calls this function. So let's just look at the function itself, which is going to be this part here. I highlighted too much. Oops. So let's correct this. This part here, this is not the function. And this stuff here, this is what the switch assembly does. So everything else is being done as part of calling the function. So let's look at, here's the actual assembly with a few annotations that XV6 uses to implement the switch function. So the first part of this is retrieving the two arguments. So remember, we said the arguments are pushed to the stack because that's the calling convention. So this reads from the stack into EAX and EDX the two arguments. So we're old and our new, or from and our to. Then I said our next step was we were going to save all the registers that weren't saved because of calling this function. So we know a bunch of registers, including EAX and EDX, were saved by the compiler because that's how you call a function. If you care about what EAX was, you better save it. But these registers here, EBP, EBX, and so on, those are callee saved. So if we want them to be the same way after we switch to B, we need to save them ourselves. So we're going to save them by pushing them on the stack. So then we do the operation of actually saving our stack pointer. So we need to know where we save these registers. So we stash the stack pointer, ESP, and what was pointed to by our first argument. So that's this first move instruction. And once we've done that, we take our second argument and make it our new stack pointer. So at that point, now, you know, for the rest of this code, we're going to be on the B stack. And we're starting on the B stack at the location that was previously saved by when B called this function. So it's going to be right after B pushed its EDI. And that means we can pop its EDI and pop all those other callee save registers and then return back to where that call to switch in B happened. Questions about how this assembly works? And I know some of you aren't used to reading AT&T syntax assembly, which is why there are the comments on a bunch of the instructions. So, and just to be clear, this here means EAX gets the value in memory stored at the address ESP, which is the stack pointer, plus 4. Yes. Sorry? So question is, how do we interact with the caller safe registers? So that is not part of this code because calling this function needs to save those registers. Because if you're calling this function, you are a caller. So the code that calls this function in A and B is going to save those registers if it needs to. Yes?
Is it saving the stack pointer to the thread A kernel stack right now?
Question, are we saving the stack pointer to the thread A kernel stack? No. So here, we are storing the stack pointer in the location pointed to by EAX. And so what is EAX? EAX is a value we retrieved from our first argument. So we use the first argument to determine where to save the stack pointer. Does that answer your question? Yes.
So EAX is the from context and then EDX is the to context?
Question, EAX is the from and EDX is the to? Yes. Other questions? Okay, so this gives us the sort of kernel part of switch. And as I mentioned, we still have to deal with the user space part. So the user space part is before we called switch, we have the trup frame strup that was allocated as part of the first thing we do when an exception happens and is going to be restored as part of the last thing we do before we return from an exception. That's where that's going to be saved. And there's one other piece we haven't dealt with that we're going to talk more about when we talk about virtual memory much later in the semester, which is the address space part. So I mentioned when we switch context, I mentioned like we have the registers, but we also have the address space, because in process A and process B, like, you have different stuff you can access in user mode. How do we make that happen? So there's some other code that does that that we'll talk about later. So that's our context switch overall. I probably should have used this slide for this. So changing address spaces, the primary function which does this, that we'll talk about how it works later, is something called switch UVM. That changes the address space mapping. So that's something that's also going to be called in a context switch separately from the switch function. But we're still missing a piece that we'll get to in a bit about how we start a new thread. We'll talk about that as our next topic. So questions about any other missing pieces other than starting a new thread? So since we talked about how the context switch works, let's do this little exercise here. So here I have a program that I'm saying, this is a program that I run in user mode. It's a very simple program. It just counts up forever. And my question is, when XV6 switches away from this program because it's going to run for too long, where is EAX going to be stored? The EAX that's being used to count up. And you can check with your neighbor. Give you a minute. So the question is, there's no difference between calling save or call save? There's no difference from the hardware point of view.
Yeah, in the hardware point of view.
Yes. Yeah, it's entirely a decision, arbitrary decision made by compiler writers.
So my question is, like, why did they design this so that they're saving it, like, you know, in like a different order instead of like saving them all?
Question, why did XV6 do it that way? Because XV6 is written to be used with compilers. Because XV6 wanted to take advantage of what the compiler does. Okay, who'd like some more time? Okay, so who thinks the answer is A, the loops user stack, B, loops kernel stack, okay, C, the user stack that we switch to, D, the kernel stack that we switch to, E, the heap, F, some special register stored in some register, and G, somewhere else, but it's okay, so we have pretty good consensus that's the kernel stack, and that is correct. So this is running in user mode, and it's stored in the kernel stack, and you might say, well, why is that? So I think the thing which confuses people most here is that, you know, this is where the storing is happening. It's this part of this process. And it happens in kernel mode, so we better be using the kernel stack. And we know it doesn't happen in user mode because we have the full code that runs, and there's nothing in this code that runs in user mode. that can possibly write EAX to the stack. So it has to be done by code that's not here, and it has to be not part of the program, therefore it's part of the kernel. It's something that happens on an exception. So questions about this? Okay, so let's do alternate version of this. So where's the program counter that it had when it last was running in user mode stored? Okay, who'd like some more time? Okay, so who thinks it's A, the user stack? Okay, B, the kernel stack? C, the user stack we switched to? D, the kernel stack we switched to? Okay, E, the heap? G, F, some special register? Or G, somewhere else? Okay, so we have a plurality saying the kernel stack again, but there's some disagreement. So this is one of the things that's also in the trap frame. So how can we know that? So it's what we were last running in user mode. So it's where we need to return after, you know, this timer interrupt happens. So it has to be saved around here. It's saved by the processor as it happens, but it's put in the trap frame because it has to be put, you know, somewhere in kernel mode. There's no code to save it on the user stack. And as a general rule, when we're writing an OS, we don't want to mess with the user stack because that's not ours. We don't want to mess with the user stack. We don't want, like, when you press a key, it messes up your stack. That would be very weird to debug if that caused any bugs. So we're going to put it on the kernel stack. And we want to put it on A's kernel stack. So one reason I know it's on A's kernel stack is that, well, we're going to save it before we even know that we want to switch away from A. So it would have to be on A's kernel stack, or we would just loop in this example. Because when I save it, I don't even know that I'm going to switch away. Another reason we can say we don't put it on the stack of any kind of the thing we're switching to is, let's say we have three threads. Let's say I had loop and B and C. If I switch from loop to B, B to C, and then C to loop, if it's saved on B's stack, that would be really inconvenient to do that switch from C to loop. So we probably should avoid doing that. So questions about this exercise? Yes. So the answer is B, yes. Other questions? Yeah.
Would it be valid to also answer the question by saying that the stack pointer is going to be stored in the RSP register, which is one of the registers that the program is using, and all registers are going to end up on the kernel stack, or is that something?
So question, could I answer this question by saying where the stack pointer is stored? So the program counter is not the stack pointer. Yes, not the stack. Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
Processor level with the context being switched. So we registers on the processor are flushed, or well, they're saved first, and then they're flushed to be replaced with the registers of the program it's switching to.
So the question is, at the processor level, when we switch from one to another, the registers are flushed and saved. So most of this process is a software process. So the hardware helps us a little bit because it has exceptions. And to implement exceptions, it's going to save, put the program counter somewhere where you can get it. And also the stack, old stack pointer somewhere where you can get it. But other than that, all the work is going to be done in software. Which is why we push the registers on the stack, but we had code to do that. So the process is that, you know, we have code that runs that saves the registers and restores the new, saves the old registers and restores the new ones. And it's not something where, except for little pieces, the hardware is actually helping us. Does that answer your question? Yeah. Other questions? Okay, so we had one piece that we're kind of missing. And that's that I told you switch is we call switch and return from another call to switch, which has this problem that we need to first call the switch, and how do we possibly do that? And how do we switch to, in particular, a new thread? And the trick we're going to use is that we're going to still use switch to switch to a new thread. We're not going to have like a separate function for that. But we're going to set up a stack as if we had a thread that was in the middle of something, so we can switch to it. So we're going to construct a stack very carefully as if it was running some code that just called switch. So we're going to construct that stack, and then we can call switch with it. And because the stack is carefully written out as if it was in the middle of a call to switch, switch will just do what it usually does, pop things from that stack, and it will work. And this is, in fact, what XV6 does. So XV6 function alloc proc creates a new process. Part of creating a new process is creating a new thread. And to do this, we have our kernel stack. We have this stack pointer where we're going to build out a stack starting at the top of the stack, the highest address. So we set our stack pointer to point there. And then we push on the stack a trap frame. We know that we want to pretend we're in the middle of handling an exception. If we're handling an exception, then we're going to have a trap frame in the kernel stack to save the registers for that exception. So we're going to allocate space on our stack for that, and also we're possibly going to set these registers to values we want them to have when we start the new thread, when we return to user mode in the new thread, I should say. And we know that in order to call, you know, to have an exception, not only do we have this saved trap frame, we also have a call to trap. That means that we must have written a return address on the stack from calling trap. So we're going to write the return address that would have been written by calling trap. And that call to trap needs to happen in the middle of something else. And we're going to pretend it happened in the middle of a system call. So we're going to write a return address that corresponds to a system call, the end of a system call function. And the system call we're going to choose, for reasons we'll learn next week, is called fork. So forkret is a part of the fork system call that we're going to return to. And that's what switch is going to think called it. I think it was called from the beginning of this forkret function. And that forkret function is going to return, and it's going to return back to where trap goes, trap returns to. So we set up this stack so it works. And, well, we need one more thing, and that's we need to have the save registers as if we called switch. So we're going to set up, put some values on the stack that switch would have pushed. So when switch pops things, it has something to pop. So that's how we start a new thread. So we just carefully construct this stack with the same layout that these functions would have normally. And this means that, of course, to do this, the XV6 authors have to know exactly what these functions put on the stack. But they've done that, you know, because, well, the trap calling function's written in assembly, so they know exactly what it is. And they have these very simple the switch function's written in assembly, so they know exactly what it wants on the stack. And these other functions, the function in between is very simple. It doesn't put anything on the stack. So we have a stack, which, if we look at it, we're like trying to figure out, you know, if you know, I was an expert in XV6 and looked at the stack, it would look to me like, oh, this function's in the middle of a call to a system call and about to return. And that's what it looks like. And that's why switching to it's going to work out fine. We're going to switch to it, and it's going to be as if we made a system call, just finished up a system call. And because we constructed the struct, that's the same as if we were in the middle of a system call and we're just finishing up. Okay. Questions about this idea of just building the stack sort of directly as if we're in the middle of a call? And so because XV6 does this, it doesn't need to have like special code to handle like switching to a new thread. Though you might argue that this is maybe more complicated than that would be, maybe it is. But that's what they chose to do. Okay, so earlier I mentioned on this idea of a process control block, the data structure represents a process, and we said in XV6 it was a struct proc. So let's look at what's in a struct proc. So this is struct proc in XV6. And it has a whole bunch of different information. So we have our context information. So we have the track frame, that TF, that's our information that was saved on entry to an exception. And we also have this context, which is, remember, when we switch away from a program, it tells us, you know, the top of the stack and where the save registers are. So this is where we store our context information if we're not currently running. If we're currently running, well, maybe it's on the processor, depending on what state we're in. So that's sort of an obvious thing we need in our thread and process control blocks. We also have a pointer to the beginning of our kernel stack. You might say, why do we have this? If we have the context, isn't that kind of redundant? Maybe it is. But this exists primarily because we're going to need to free the kernel stack later on. So this is what we're going to pass to free, and this is also what was returned from malloc, or the equivalent of malloc in the kernel. Because when we start a new process or new thread, we need to allocate a new stack, so we need to use something that's malloc-like to do that. We also need information about whether the process is running or not. So we have this state variable, which can be unused, this embryo state for being set up, but in use. Something sleeping, meaning like waiting for input or something like that, and runnable or running. So runnable means you could switch to it. Running means it's on a processor right now, so probably don't switch to it because you're already running it. And this special state called zombie we'll talk about later. Also, when a process is in this sleeping state, it's waiting for something, we need to know what it's waiting for. Why do we need to know that? Well, because if a key press happens, we need to like figure out who's waiting for a key press. And in XV6, that information is stored in this chan variable, which says what we're waiting for. We also have this killed flag. We've kind of seen that earlier when we looked at the trap function, which says it has this process been set up to be terminated, but not like completely terminated, because we have to run some cleanup code to terminate it. We also have a process ID. We have to do things where we have to identify what process to do them to. Like there's a system call to terminate a process forcefully called kill. That takes a PID because we have to say which process to do that to. We also have information about the address space. So we'll talk much more about what this is later. We have our page directory, page table, and we have how big the heap is. We also have information about open files. So each process, you can open and close files. You have to track that somewhere. This is where it's tracked. That's part of our process. And I mentioned that XV6 kind of conflates the process and thread control block. So what I would say is that these things here are part of, I would say, are more part of a thread control block. So if XV6 had multiple threads, we'd probably have those items would be in a separate struct, and we'd have an array of them in each process. And the other things would typically, if we had multiple threads per process, would be shared between all those threads. Okay, so questions about the contents of our process control block in XV6? Okay, so that's our process control block. And how do you get it? We've actually seen this before. So we saw this myproc, and that retrieves a pointer to the current struct proc. And you might ask, well, how does this work? So as I told you, it was like a pseudo-global variable. But you might say, why isn't it just a real global variable? We can have global variables. There are, in fact, a bunch of them in XV6. So why do we not use a global variable for this, for the currently running process? Why is there a function to retrieve this? Well, let's look at the function. So this function retrieves a struct CPU using this myCPU function and then gets a pointer from that. So XV6 supports multiple cores, which they call CPUs. And the myCPU function, there's an array of struct CPUs, depending on for every possible number of cores. And the myCPU function reads a special register from the processor that says which core are we on, and retrieves that entry of the array. So the purpose of myproc is that we want to have basically a separate proc variable for each core. So it does achieves that. Okay. Yes. So the question, how is myproc loaded and offloaded in the thread switch? So another thing I didn't tell you about switching from one thread to the other is we have to do the bookkeeping to update the current process. And when we talk about how we choose what thread to switch to, we'll see that code. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so in the interest of being in sync with the other section, I'm going to stop here for today. So apparently I'm slow in the mornings, which is usually more what I expect. So from a normal semester, not being slower in this class, which, sorry. So see you next week. Remember, we have a quiz. Oh, question, yes. This is assumed that, no, because the myCPU function here says what core are we on, and retrieves the appropriate struct CPU for that. Question, what if there are multiple processes running on each core? So only one process can run at a time.
Oh.
On a core. So that's, it retrieves the one that's currently running or nothing.